This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Severe acute respiratory syndrome is an epidemic in its infancy. The World Health Organization put travelers on notice about the disease just last month when it warned that outbreaks of an atypical pneumonia had been observed in several countries in East Asia. Thus far, the disease has claimed hundreds of lives. China, Singapore, and Canada are particularly hard hit. Though the United States has yet to document its first death from SARS, the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, has documented close to 200 suspected cases. Affected governments are using everything from surgical masks to quarantines to control the spread of the disease. What can be done to control the spread of the fear is another matter. This hour, we're talking about SARS, what it is, where it is, and what you need to know about it. And we'd like to hear from you. Our phone number in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Send us whatever questions you may have about SARS. Joining us now is Joanne Silberner, an NPR health reporter. She joins us here in Studio 3A. Always good to be with you.
Good to be here, Neil.
What are the latest news developments concerning SARS internationally? I've heard a couple of Chinese officials lost their jobs.
Yeah, the mayor of Beijing is on his way out. So is the Minister of Health for the whole country. The problem was they were not reporting as many cases as they knew that they had. It was a political issue there. And one could say heads are rolling, but that might not be a great metaphor here. The other part of the non-medical side of the story is the economic impact this is having. This is really hitting Asia hard. I mean, travel and tourism are way down. They've had trade fairs there where no one has come. Airplanes are empty. Economic analysts have downgraded their projections for growth in the region because of this disease.
What about the medical side of the story?
Well, the medical side, there's really been enormous progress in an awfully short period of time. You know, I covered HIV in the beginning, and progress came in fits and starts, and researchers were battling with each other. There's been enormous cooperation here. People are working very quickly together. And last week, the big event was it became really clear that this is a coronavirus, a particular kind of a member of a family that the scientists know a little bit about, and just having the virus in hand, knowing that this is the single cause of the disease, is really going to speed up research.
Mm-hmm. Now, the disease appears to be deadlier in some countries than it is in others. Do we know any reason for that?
No, and that's a fascinating question. I mean, that's a really strange thing. It could be better medical care in some countries than others, but that's not likely. It could be luck. It could be just there could be super spreaders out there that are more efficient at spreading, so that people are getting a bigger amount of virus all at once. It could be a slightly mutated form of the virus. The best example of this, there's an apartment complex in Hong Kong, Amoy Gardens, where they've had big outbreaks, several hundred people. A lot more of them have had diarrhea in addition to the respiratory problems than others. They're sicker. 20% of them, 20% more of them need intensive care, or 20% need intensive care versus 10% of other SARS cases. I mean, there's something different going on there, and when they figure that out, it'll be a big advance.
Now, when you say a super spreader, what is that, Typhoid Mary in spades?
Nobody really knows. Again, is it that they're spreading more virus than other people? Is it that they are spreading a slightly mutated form of the virus? That's the question.
But these are carriers who are infecting other people?
Yes.
Okay. Now, here in this country, the CDC has reported 200 suspected cases of SARS. Now, what's the difference between a probable case of SARS and a suspected case?
Public health is the difference. The CDC started out just counting suspected cases. The reason they did this was they were being very conservative. They wanted to catch every possible case and isolate those people, give them good medical care, make sure the healthcare workers taking care of them knew that this could be SARS. So it was a public health measure to keep the spread. But they knew a lot of these people didn't have it, but they were being conservative. Probable means that they have the symptoms of fever. They've either been in a place that has SARS or been near a person who has SARS. But in addition to which, they have and they have some respiratory problems. The probable cases have more serious respiratory problems. They have either pneumonia or a respiratory distress syndrome that's proven. So they're the sickest of the suspected cases. These people really probably do have it. The suspected people, they wanted to be careful in case it developed into SARS.
Now, from that, I infer that there's no test yet to say, you know, we've got a drop of your blood and we'll let you know in half an hour whether you got SARS or not.
Well, there are a couple of antibody tests that the CDC has just begun distributing around to states and to hospitals. And what they don't know yet is how accurate these tests are, at what point in the – they're just learning now at what point in the disease people develop antibodies, because the antibody test won't do much good if they develop it, you know, at the end of the disease. You want one right at the beginning. So they're working with these two tests. They look pretty good. There's also a test for the virus. Again, they've got to make sure that the test, the direct test for the virus, is as accurate as they hope it will be.
Mm-hmm. Why is there such concern? I know it's scary, but, you know, we're talking about hundreds of deaths across the globe. Pneumonia, flu kill, what, tens of thousands a year?
Absolutely. Flu, the latest number that the CDC gives is 36,000 people a year in the U.S., and we've had no deaths from SARS. It's new. Nobody knows much about it. There's a chance to stop it. I mean, imagine if we could have stopped measles or mumps or any of these diseases that go through and affect people. If you can stop it early on, that's terrific. And again, it's a mystery. And anytime you've got a mystery virus going around, you want to know what's going on.
Now, you talked earlier about these Chinese officials who lost their jobs. Reporting procedures do differ among countries. Is that affecting the efforts to track the spread of AIDS, of SARS? Excuse me.
Well, what we're seeing is an uneven announcements. You know, China all of a sudden today and yesterday came in with 448 new cases. If you're looking at cases over time, you think, oh my gosh, it just started spreading really quickly. Well, it didn't. Those were older cases. But in general, I think the World Health Organization is saying that except for China, which is now cooperating, they've had pretty good cooperation. I mean, Vietnam really got on top of this right away. A lot of the countries really are coming through, and it's giving them a chance to test, you know, if there's bioterrorism or something else like that that comes along. This is sort of a dry run for something like that. They're getting to test their procedures and learn a lot about how well reporting is done.
And earlier we mentioned that, you know, that first description of it as an atypical pneumonia. Given that, is it possible that it started earlier than people thought and people died from what looked like pneumonia but was really SARS?
Could be. I mean, there were cases in November in Guangdong province, the hardest hit province, and that was the first time that health officials heard of it. If it was happening up in the hills earlier, I think we found from Legionnaires, from HIV, from a lot of the so-called new infections, when they started to look and they started to look back, they realized there were cases previously.
Joanne Tilburner, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Joanne Tilburner is here with us in Studio 3A. Joining us now to discuss SARS is Barry Bloom, Dean of the Harvard School of Public Health and an infectious disease specialist. He joins us by phone from his office on the campus. Thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Let's begin with a few basic questions. What is SARS and how is it spread?
SARS is a viral disease caused by, as far as we know, a virus that's never caused disease or infection in humans before. And it is spread primarily, as far as we can tell, by the respiratory route. As Joanne indicated, it is also possible when the plumbing leaks, as it did in the Amoy Gardens, it may also be spread by other than the respiratory route through an oral and fecal route.
Now, when you say respiratory route, that means if somebody sneezes who's got it, if you're next to him, you might get it.
That's right. The major risk for acquiring the infection is breathing.
Now, remind us, what do we know about how SARS is and isn't transmitted? It's strictly that that it has to be through that aerosol?
The suggestion is primarily through direct contact with someone who is ill, which turns out to be a very important characteristic, because if we can identify people who are ill particularly early on and isolate them, that will limit the number of people to whom they can transmit infection, and we will stop the transmission. And the number one goal in an infectious disease is to block transmission, block the accumulation of new cases.
Now, how close or far away is the medical community to finding a cure?
We're a long way away, I think, from a cure. I think the first question is, can, with the tools we have available, we actually contain it so that it starts to go away in all the places where it has broken out as outbreaks or epidemics. I would say the history, and what, put it this way, I think we have to take respiratory transmitted infections very, very seriously. We know that in 1918, influenza killed between 20 and 40 million people worldwide. We know that when children are infected with measles, it spreads like wildfire. The difference now is that we have vaccines for influenza, and we have a vaccine for measles. What we want to do is develop vaccines that will prevent the disease, but when the disease is a month old and it takes a bit of a long time to make test and license a vaccine, we're unlikely to have it in the very short term.
So rather than a treatment or a cure after you get it, the best way to deal with it is to prevent you getting it in the first place.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, what symptoms should people look out for? Joanne, I think, told us some of them.
The symptoms are a temperature and respiratory illness, cough, shortness of breath, trouble breathing. And the case definition has this peculiar characteristic of having contact with another case or being in contact either with people in a country that has reported SARS or with someone who's returned from that country. That's a critical case definition. In the wintertime in the U.S. and Canada, there are lots and lots of people with fevers and coughs. So key here is the identification of a likely contact from an endemic country.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org, where our subject is SARS. Our first caller is Tony, who's with us from Pepperell, Massachusetts.
Good afternoon, Neil.
And happy Patriots Day.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's a very timely show. My wife and I and two daughters are thinking about going to Toronto in July. And we've been planning this for a while, but now we're sort of concerned, obviously, about whether or not we should make that trip. And my question is basically is, when would we know if it is safe to travel to a town or a city or a country that has SARS? And is it good to go to the CDC website and check that out, or where?
My question. Barry Bloom?
It's a great question, and probably the hardest question for anyone to answer, because it is in the nature of epidemics to be unpredictable. I would say as long as the numbers are going up, we know that it is not yet fully under control. And what one would like to see with the alerts, with the efforts of the public health system, that those numbers start to go down. Joanne mentioned that one of the early countries attacked was Vietnam. They haven't had cases for several days now. And if that stays that way, it would suggest that they've got it under control and that one could go there quite safely. Clearly, what we would do for the students at Harvard University is ask if they do go to a country that has the infection, that they report back to us that they've been there, because it's terribly important to know if anyone has a risk for it, so if they do get sick, we can isolate everyone with whom they've been in contact. And that, regrettably, is the major tool we have to control the spread.
And that's one person really brought it to Toronto, as far as I understand it.
It's very interesting. There were actually two people who brought it to Toronto, two people to Canada, one in Toronto and from the same hotel in Hong Kong to Vancouver.
Hmm.
And the person in Vancouver went home, stayed isolated, and as far as we know, had very little transmission. And the patient in Toronto went to an emergency room and spread it there.
So, Tony, I'm afraid that wasn't much of an answer in terms of what you can actually do about Toronto. Just hang in there.
Well, it sounds good to me. Thank you very much.
Okay. We're talking about severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS, and when we come back from the break, we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-TALK, 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the infectious disease SARS and the national and international efforts to contain it. Our guest is Barry Bloom, who's dean of the Harvard School of Public Health. Of course, you're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we have an email question from Gina in St. Louis, who writes to ask, my mother is a nurse, is concerned about her own health because of the number of healthcare workers in China that have contracted this illness. She works in a small hospital in a small town. Is she at higher risk?
I think one would have to say that hospitals are not the safest place to be when it comes to a respiratory transmitted infectious disease. So that health workers really are the front line, and they do have a higher risk, particularly if they're exposed in settings before one can make a diagnosis or even a suspected one. In major hospitals, largely as a result of September 11th, I believe, there's a greater alert and greater care taken to be sure that one tries to recognize people who have symptoms of flu or respiratory infections, segregating them from other patients, often putting, as they did in Vancouver, a mask on the patient to prevent coughing into the healthcare personnel.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, I think one can reduce the risk not to zero, but a great deal more than by simply casual contact.
Well, joining us now is Bhagirath Singh. He is the scientific director of the Institute of Infection and Immunity at the Canadian Institute of Health. He joins us on the phone from his office in London, Ontario, about a two-hour drive from Toronto. And good of you to be with us.
Good afternoon.
How widespread is SARS in Canada?
Well, it's basically contained in Toronto. It's not that widespread across the country. Few cases in Vancouver, but mainly Toronto is our hotspot.
Mm-hmm. Now, Toronto has been struggling with this outbreak. Some hospitals have restricted access by preventing visitors. One hospital was shut down, as I understand it, quarantined. Are hospitals able to contain it, or are they somehow part of the problem?
Well, as Dr. Bloom just mentioned, the hospitals are the front line, and in this case, the first case, in fact, never made to the hospital. It was the second case, the son of the person who passed away, who actually brought it to the first hospital, and that hospital was eventually quarantined, controlled, and closed, and now it's opening actually this week again.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, this has gotten a great deal of attention in the Canadian media, the outbreak, particularly in Toronto. Are you worried that there could be an overreaction in Canada to SARS, and is there anything the public health sector can do to stop that?
Well, there's no question that the first outbreak of any kind in the Western Hemisphere of this nature has to be taken seriously. Toronto has taken all the steps they can at this point. We cannot really be sure that it's contained at this point, but given the magnitude of response in Canada and the public reaction to that response has been understandable. So from our perspective, I think we have done what need to be done at this point. But are we at a point of controlling the disease? The answer is we still don't know.
Mm-hmm. Barry Bloom, the same question. If there have been no deaths from SARS in the United States as yet, but are you worried about an overreaction?
I'm not worried about an overreaction as much as I am concerned that we will wait until we have an outbreak, an epidemic, or an illness of serious proportions before we do begin to take it seriously.
Hmm.
I think the first line of defense in the hospitals particularly understand the threat and are pretty well prepared. On the other hand, I have to say that many physicians would find it very difficult to establish personal relations with patients, which is vital to the doctor-patient relationship, if they're wearing a mask all day. And I think that compliance with safety regulations may be very difficult to enforce because of the concern of not frightening people within settings like hospitals.
Go ahead. I heard you wanted to say something there.
Well, I was just going to mention that that's an understandable reaction. And what happened in case in Toronto, the first few physicians and healthcare workers who came in contact were the first victims of the spread of the disease. So from that perspective, I think Toronto has learned that we have to take measures. How long it will continue, can you be at that level of alert, is not practical. I think we have to basically make sure that the sooner the better we are able to contain this spread. And if that is not the case, we have to then decide what is the next step.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's the public's role in this? Obviously, they're hearing and listening to all of this media stuff and reading it.
Well, the media is critical in making sure that public understand the seriousness of the disease and the measures which have been taken to contain it. In Canada, we had unfortunate cases, at least one in Toronto, where the healthcare worker actually went to work after being put in quarantine because it wasn't a mandatory quarantine, it was voluntary quarantine. And those kind of things can have a measure of unpredictability in terms of spreading the disease. So we really have to advice to the public that they have to take this very seriously when it's been advised to either go in quarantine or isolate themselves. Without that, I don't think that we can really make it work. It is public who we need to cooperate in this case.
We're speaking with Bhagirath Singh, Scientific Director of the Canadian Institute of Health's Institute of Infection and Immunity, who's with us from London, Ontario, and with Barry Bloom, Dean of Harvard School of Public Health, from his office on the campus there in Boston. Let's get back to the phones. Our next caller is Jack, who's with us in Whitsitt, North Carolina.
Good afternoon. My question concerned the origin of the disease, having come from China. It seems to me that I remember several other types of viruses have come from the Orient as well, and I just wondered what the connection was with the Orient and the start or the spread of a disease of this nature.
I'm not sure. Barry Bloom, do you have a...
I'd be happy to try. The origin of the experience with this is influenza. And the probable reason that it often arises in Asia is that there are lots of different influenza viruses that infect birds and pigs as well as humans. And often the bird virus, for example, doesn't infect humans, but it can infect pigs. And the pig virus can infect humans. So what happens during the course of a year is people are infected with new viruses generated in an animal species that then somehow get into human populations that live in close contact with animals on farms. And that creates the new strains that travel around the world almost every year. The extraordinary thing is, that I think is very important to recognize, is the World Health Organization has created a network of laboratories that identifies the strains that are likely to go around the world, the most likely, and then provide those strains to the vaccine companies that make vaccines within record time every year of about 9 months to protect us against the new strains that evolve. On the logic of what we have just seen with SARS, it is possible, since we know coronaviruses infect animals, birds have a very severe disease from it, that it too has arisen by mixed infection in some animals that then inadvertently jumped into humans. And we would have the same hope as we do for flu, that we could develop a vaccine that would prevent it.
Would that not also make it possible to go back to the source and try to stop it there?
One could try. It would be pretty expensive to try to vaccinate all the birds in China or all the pigs in China, but it's not out of the question.
Okay. Jack, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to Tanya, who's with us from Grand Junction, Colorado.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air, Tanya.
Hi. I was wondering if it doesn't sound like it, but does it cause immunity once you get it? If you get it and get over it, does it cause immunity?
Oh, I see. It's like one of those mumps or something. If you get it once, you never get
right,
it again?
Like chickenpox, right.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Singh, do you have a...
Well, I think we don't know exactly whether you But most people will recover from the disease. 4% fatality is what currently being reported. But the question still remains, can you be reinfected? If it's a coronavirus which has similarity to cold, we seem to get over cold, but then some other variety of cold comes along and you get another cold. But maybe it's not the same virus. And so is virus mutating? The strain in Toronto is more virulent than the strain somewhere else. Those kind of questions need to be answered, and we don't have the answers yet.
So, okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call, Tanya.
Bye.
Let's go now to DJ, who's in Denver.
Yes, hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. My question is, how high is the risk of in indoor swimming pools and pretty soon outdoor swimming pools, but the indoor swimming pools right now?
Barry Bloom?
I'd be keen on the outdoor swimming pool because anything that's transmitted by a respiratory infection has much less chance when the wind is dispersing the little droplets that come out from breathing. I wouldn't think a swimming pool would provide any particular extra hazard if it is only transmitted by a respiratory route. If it can come out from an oral route or an oral fecal route, then, as was the case years ago with polio, then swimming pools could be, in fact, a source. But we have no evidence of that that I know of, except the plumbing failure in Hong Kong.
Bagheera Singh, let me ask you, would the chemicals that are used to treat water in swimming pools, chlorine and the like, would that kill off the virus?
Well, they might, but we don't know exactly what will kill off the virus, but it certainly can contain it, at least for a short period of time. I think the concern which has recently been raised, how long the virus will survive in free form, CDC is reporting that it can survive 24 hours, which is a bit unusual in an outdoor environment.
Is that a long time or a short time?
It is a bit longer time than other things which can survive on a free floating surface, as far as virus or bacteria is concerned. Dr. Bloom is an expert on this. He may be able to comment on it more.
Dr. Bloom?
Well, TB, which is also transmitted by a respiratory route, can hang around for days. So this is not the longest and most infectious agent we know about. But 24 hours for a virus out in the light, particularly in the air, is a bit of a long time, which means I would think we would want to wash our hands reasonably frequently to be sure we haven't picked up virus that settled on banisters or any other part of buildings.
And by mentioning light, sunlight is something that works to break up viruses?
We don't know that for this virus, but, yeah, not many things like to hang out in the sunshine, and UV light tends to inactivate many viruses in the laboratory.
Okay. DJ, thanks for the question.
And did I understand it right to prefer the outside to the indoor pool?
I think that's what they said.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Ever so much.
Dress warmly if you do.
Thank you.
Here in the headlines at NPR today, tens of thousands of Shiite Muslims in Iraq are making a pilgrimage long prohibited under Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. They're honoring the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. NPR's Steve Inskeep is in the Iraqi city of Karbala and will have details. Also, President Bush's cabinet is fanning out across the country to highlight the president's domestic agenda. We'll hear from NPR's Don Gagne at the White House about the administration's effort to rally support for tax cuts. You can hear those stories on All Things Considered from NPR News later today. You're listening now to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's go to Jean, who's with us from the Silicon Valley in California.
Hi. I really have a comment, which is that I feel the SARS thing already has a huge overreaction. I'm just back from a two-week trip to China. I've been back 9 days. And my employer, for whom I only work one day a week, refuses to let me return to work until 2 weeks have gone by. They won't let me come back to work until the 28th.
You're feeling fine?
I feel fine. I was in Beijing. I was in Shanghai. I've been back 9 days now, and I'm breathing fine.
Dr. Singh, is there any reason that her employer should be concerned?
Well, I think anybody traveling to Southeast Asia right now, people are concerned. And, you know, whether she has symptoms or not, and that's the issue. Can we identify the virus and the tests and so on have not been developed to a stage where we can really say to someone, you don't have it. I think the clinical symptoms are what we are going by. That is a bit unfortunate, but I think that's where the diagnosis is. And if that's the case, people need to take precautions, but should they be stay indoors and not leave home? Those are decisions, I think, very difficult ones, and I'm not sure how to respond to that.
So you don't know how long the incubation period of this
is? Well, it is known between 3 to 10 days. I mean, we know the incubation period, 10 days probably, where if you don't come down with something, then you are fine. And most quarantines here in Canada are 2 weeks at the most.
So, Jean, it sounds as if you'll be able to get back to work reasonably soon anyway.
Well, no, I mean, I actually offered to come in wearing a mask and gloves and after the 10-day period, and they said, no, absolutely not.
Really?
Yeah.
Is there any way that Dr. Singh, that her employer, she could direct her employer to look for information that would reassure him that after 2 weeks or so she'd be okay?
Oh, yeah, there are lots of, you know, on CDC website, you can go Health Canada website. They're all basically giving 2 weeks as a reasonable time frame for quarantine. I don't think beyond that it's at this point necessary. And
it's interesting. My husband, actually, who has a full-time 5-day-a-week job, is already back to work in his lab. They sort of asked him to wear a mask the first few days, and then after about 3 or 4 days, they got sort of, you know, tired of seeing him in the mask, I think, and sort of got over it.
So you never thought you'd star in your own version of Outbreak, did you?
No, yeah. That's really a good way of putting it. I want to say, I mean, I think that, you know, even if the Chinese government is totally underreporting what they're saying. I mean, 300 cases in a population of 13 million is actually a really small proportion of the population. And I just feel like the people I talked to here seemed to think that people were dropping in the streets, and I was stepping over, you know, bodies as I walked to the tourist destinations. And it's I can see that there's a good reason for healthcare professionals to really have a great deal of concern, and healthcare professionals should really be aware of this. It's not, I don't know what the precise definition of an epidemic is, but it just seems like it's a small proportion of the population that's actually affected. I just wonder if some of what's getting reported isn't sort of leading to this atmosphere of, like, that it is outbreak. And in that movie, everybody sort of gets this immediately, and they sort of, like, fall down in this horrible bleeding death, and I think that's what people are sort of afraid is happening.
Regrettably, Dustin Hoffman survives.
Pardon?
Never mind, just a joke.
Well, that issue has been raised because in Canada we have a problem, people coming to Toronto. In fact, Harvard has declared that Toronto is off limits to their faculty, and we had several meetings, scientific meetings, which have been impacted by people coming from Boston and other areas. So there are concerns, not people dying in Toronto, but the concern of outbreak is there. It's not epidemic, but it's still an outbreak of sorts. And the main issue is the healthcare workers. You know, are the front line, and they've been taking the proper precautions so that they don't spread the disease. And I absolutely agree that the risk for general population is very, very small. The disease only spread through personal contacts, and that's something has to be kept in mind.
Jean, thanks very much for the call, and good luck.
Thanks.
Okay, Bagirath Singh, we appreciate your time with us today.
You're welcome.
Bagirath Singh is scientific director of the Canadian Institute of Health's Institute of Infection and Immunity. More on SARS when we come back from a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, the first in our series on tough choices in state budget making. Governors and state assemblies are forced to make difficult decisions about cutting services to save money. Tomorrow at this time, we'll look at how the budget crunch is affecting education. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Right now, we're talking about SARS with Barry Bloom, dean of the Harvard School of Public Health. He's with us by phone from his office on campus there in Cambridge. And in a few minutes, get out your deck of most wanted cards for a game of who's caught and who's not from the regime of Saddam Hussein. But Barry Bloom, there are several questions we wanted to finish up with on SARS. And one of them is it possible for people who don't have the symptoms, the fever, the respiratory problems, is it possible for somebody without symptoms to transmit this disease?
We really don't know for certain, but it seems that every case that has been tracked down had been exposed to someone else who, in fact, was sick. And that's the good news. That is, if we can identify people who are ill and keep them from contacting many other people, keep them at home, have them isolated, we have a chance of really containing the epidemic. There is not a lot of evidence yet that people are able to transmit before they themselves are sick. If there were such, or carriers, it would make it a very much more difficult problem. We don't see that yet.
Okay. An email question from Ryan Delahanty. A vaccine seems to be developed each year for influenza, so why can't a SARS vaccine be quickly developed and distributed by the same channels? And he's got a couple of others. How does the existing test for SARS work, and why don't they use a PCR-based test, which I assume you know what that means? I don't.
Wow. Yes, we have learned over the years, over very many years, how to make an influenza vaccine somewhat differently with different strains each year. The companies are tooled up. They have all the equipment. They have already been through the FDA in past years. They know exactly what they have to do, batch-by-batch testing. This is a brand-new virus. We are not even clear how to kill it and maintain its ability to immunize. So there's a lot of research to be done on how to create a vaccine, whether it has to be live and mutated, whether it can be pickled and formaldehyde and work as a dead vaccine, whether we need pieces of it. So that's going to take a bit of time to know what the best and safest way to generate an immune response is. Second, we don't know whether there's only one strain of virus out there or whether the people who have more severe disease develop mutants or other strains. So we still have research on that yet to be done. And then once the science is done, there's a major, major challenge to industry rapidly to produce enough to be useful and have it tested and be safe.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to go to a question from a caller in Rochester, New York, who'd been very patient, and she was going on a cruise and was worried that SARS could be transmitted through ventilation vents, air passage, stuff like that. Is that a problem?
The data from Toronto, or is the best that I know, indicate pretty much close contact is required, close household members. There have been some contacts on airplanes, but only people in very close proximity. So it doesn't look like it's easy to get in the ventilation systems and traipse around whole buildings. So I don't think that's a great likelihood of being a major source. That isn't to say that it couldn't.
Okay. And finally, is the United States public health system prepared to deal with SARS?
I think we're more prepared now than we were before October 5th, 2001, when anthrax hit. I think emergency rooms in big hospitals have gone through lots of preparation. We're concerned about two things. One is bioterrorism, and the second is the nightmare of a 1918-like influenza that will sweep around the world and one to which we have no prior immune experience. Having said that, the answer to the question really is that it has to be of very significant concern that we will not, when it first hits, inconvenience people like your earlier caller and get the full compliance of the public to say it's worth my staying home 10 days, even if I feel healthy, knowing that the majority of people who've been to China or Vietnam or Toronto are never going to be exposed. But that's their contribution to the public health, because the one or two who have been exposed and transmit it put many other people in jeopardy.
So it's up to all of us, really.
It's up to all of us.
Barry Bloom, thanks very much. Barry Bloom is Dean of the Harvard School of Public Health, and he joined our conversation about SARS by phone from his office on campus.